accession number 28626, reel 10.
What about news from home? You know, you've mentioned, you know, you're getting films and, like, the rating and things like that. When you're getting, like, no, I don't know, you might have internet access now, but you didn't have it then.
No.
But, you know, when you're getting news out about what was happening maybe back in the UK or something?
We certainly got the papers, but they were probably 4 or 5 days old. But that didn't matter. You know, you could read them and you say, oh, that's what's been happening. I was courting my wife at that stage. And so I was writing Blueies. I've never been a great writer, but I was certainly writing one letter a week. It would be quite long and just saying what we'd been up to. There's no point in repeating the same stuff. So I just, I would do that. And she would respond. So I was hearing news, not all the news, but you know, you're hearing bits and pieces that were of interest. But the papers were getting through, so we were probably 5 days behind. And you get, you know, the P&J and the Observer or the Express, or, you know, both tabloids and the ordinary papers, and you could broadsheets and you could just look at them. And we always got enough so that the lads had their papers, Sergeant Press and the Officer Press had theirs. So I think nothing went to waste. It was all good. And I think probably Jim Essence probably used the newspapers for his bridge plants. So I said, damn good.
And when you say a blue, is that an air mail?
Yeah, a blue is an air mail, yeah.
And how often would the mail come out? Would it be once a week to take the thing? Or?
I think it was more often than that, to be honest. I think every time there was a flight that would come down from Belize City, there would be a bag, a blue bag, mail bag. And that would then go into the order room and it would be sorted by one of the corporals in there and then put out to the platoons. For the platoon sergeant to dispatch for us.
Okay. So it sounds as though it was quite well organized.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, very. It was thoroughly enjoyable. It was a very interesting place to go. Not everybody got a chance to go to Belize. My brother didn't get there. He served with the Queen's Highlanders for 12 years. He didn't get there. You know, so it was a very interesting experience. Working in the jungle, working in that sort of temperature. We had a job to do. The Guatemalans were a little fractious and hostile in some areas. So I can see why we were there. Not the case now, of course. You know, there's a very, very, very small military presence there now. The ship, our navy, is still there, but we don't have the same army and RAF scope there anymore.
Okay. And you mentioned, Ed, that you had vehicles out there as well. How did you get the petrol in for them? Did that...
It was all flown in.
It was flown in as well?
Flown in, straightforwardly, but at least once a month, there would be, the brave ones would put a convoy together, and there'd be 8 or 9 lorries with a wrecking vehicle with them, would travel from the north to the south, and to the outlying companies, the Holdfast, the A Company, and the Gurkhas. I still can't remember the name of the camp that they were at. It was in the higher up in not quite in the jungle as we were. It was slightly higher up, and therefore was broken country, and but much nearer the border.
And why did you call them the brave ones?
Because it was a very, very bad road. It took days to get these vehicles down. The roads were quite often wash away or breaking up at the sides. You weren't quite sure what to expect. You could have been ambushed. You could have been attacked by locals who just needed supplies, or by Guatemalans who'd come in on a foraging mission. it was difficult, and when you were doing these things, you quite often put the helicopters down the routes beforehand just to have a look and say, look, we've got a bridge down here, you know, stop, well short, just in case something's happened, you know, or the, because there weren't that many alternative routes. Quite often these convoys didn't make it, you know, they were turned back because the situation, the river was too high and they couldn't ford it, or the bridge had been washed away, or, you know, they couldn't hold the weight of the lorry. So, you know, that's how it happened.
Okay. And was it ever
there was one attack in my time there. It wasn't by Guatemalans, it was by locals who knew what was being transported and just wanted it, because they were very poor. They were very poor. Nobody was hurt, and I think only one vehicle had this provision still.
Okay.
But they did block the road, and that's what caused it. Is, you know, and, you know, the truth is, I don't think that the soldiers who were running these convoys really wanted to shoot them, because it wasn't hostile. We knew exactly what it was done. But you wouldn't want to create a diplomatic incident by shooting 20, peasants who had machetes and long-handled pointy sticks and stuff.
And when the convoys were going over, when you yourself went out as well, would you normally be armed?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We all carried weapons. And ammunition, claymore mines, grenades. But you were well armed. You had lots of ammunition on you. We thought we carried lots of ammunition until such time as the Guatemalans actually made hostile noises about crossing the border. And then we really discovered what a lot of ammunition was. Oh, I'll never forget Nick Anell, the lad who burned himself in sunbathing. He was issued, a 4 tonnes worth of ammunition for his platoon. I mean, you just couldn't physically carry it all. But that's what he had to stock up with and take with him. We put ammunition out with us to the Keys, and you took these fast patrol boats out, and they were absolutely full of ammunition. And you'd sit out there, you'd have a section on each one of these keys with ammunition. I mean, I don't know how long you'd have been stuck there for. You can't eat ammunition, but...
And the Guatemalans as well, you know how you said you were sometimes at these lookout points, and did you ever have any idea how well armed they were? You know, could you see, or was it too far away?
No, you could certainly see the Sanger that we were responsible for, and I didn't see the Sangers that A Company or the Gurkha Company looked after, but the Sangers that we looked after, they were all overlooking Guatemala. Now, the main one, which had a strong section, half platoon in it, that was a very high Sanger built on this rocky promontory, and it overlooked Guatemala. It would have been half a mile away, but you were looking right down into this huge valley, and on the other side of the valley, at a prominent junction of various roads, was this quite large Guatemalan camp. And you could quite clearly, with the binoculars we had and the viewing devices, see into it day and night. It was lit up, but all the Guatemalans were carrying weapons. I would have said most of them were originally of Russian or Chinese origin. They were all sort of AKs and PKK-type weapons. They had ammunition, they had mortars, field mortars, the sort of things that we would expect to see, because we'd been given a list of the sort of armaments that they would have, and we had a checklist and a plastic folder with these things in. So, and we had a camera, and we could take pictures. The other Sangers were looking just into valleys, really, and their job was to basically observe any unusual build-up of forces in these significant points, because these are points that led into Belize. So if you see these happening, you say, this is unusual. We've suddenly got this happening on the radio. The Harrier would appear pretty quickly and do his business, and then it all disappear. that was a good thing about Harriers.
And when you were mentioning, the arms and things, I was also wondering, did you ever try and listen into their airwaves or anything, or did the broadcast, for example?
I'm quite sure people were doing just that. None of our boys were Spanish speakers, so we didn't do that, but there would have been signals and intelligence and special forces working, doing just that. But from our point of view, I'm afraid it was just the old Mark II eyeball and whatever communication we had over HF link mainly. UHF VHF wasn't particularly good. UHF did work, and the Sangers had UHF radio, so they could speak to the jets if they had to.
Okay, and when you were speaking about the aircraft as well, was there ever the possibility, apart from the helicopters, that an aircraft would come into where you were? I've heard people saying that they sometimes were in radio contact with some of the planes, but was there somewhere that could land?
We certainly couldn't land. There's no question, none of the Harriers could land anywhere. Okay. The Pumas could land. Quite often when we're out on patrol, you'd actually clear an area for a helicopter to come in and either resupply you or move you, because you got geographically embarrassed, you got lost. or when you had a casualty. So you had to have the ability to create an LZ, an LS, a landing site for a puma. And quite often, these pumas would literally, they could lower a rope down through the tree canopies, and you would get a hold of that and climb up the rope, depending on what was wrong. Or they could lower stuff down that way. When he had a casualty, they always tended to want to land properly on the ground, which is understandable. One of the sangers, the main sanger we had, it was in such a precarious position, the helicopter could only come in and put one wheel down, and it would hover there because the mountain went away, 800 feet almost straight down. So it would sit there with its wheel on the bit of rock, and the guys would just file out and file back in again. But the pilots were really very good. They could do that. The scariest thing about flying at the RAF was they'd go flat out across the canopy of the trees, and then suddenly there'd be an enormous drop in the sort of terrain, and the helicopter would just drop into this hole, and the trees would be above you, and you were weightless. You experienced weightlessness for a couple of seconds. And, oh God, your heart was in your mouth, and it was just the scariest thing because of course they could see it happening. And we're inside looking in at each other, and this thing suddenly just drops. Oh, what's going wrong? And that was always funny. Funny, ha ha, yeah, but it was an experience. But these were just, I suppose, going back years, that they were created by water. And as the land has risen, these sort of, I suppose, open caves have filled in, and the trees have grown in them. But they're still so much lower than the rest of the land around them. But it was always interesting.
And did you build up any type of relationship, with the pilots or anything? Did you see them quite often?
Well, no, we because we were down south, we didn't have any relationship with the pilots. Mm-hmm. What was interesting, two Harrier pilots died when we were there. Their aircraft malfunctioned, I think was the word would be, and they crashed, and the pilots and navigators... or pilots or navigator were killed. We lost two guys. Most would eject, but we still lost two. And I happened to be up at Battlefield North one day at APC camp, and one guy just died. And we were just getting ready to fly away. And all these guys came out and said, come on, it's the mess. He thought, what the hell's happening? He went in there, and there were dozens of blokes in there, mainly the RAF. But a lot of army and a lot of logistic people who worked in ABC, drinking like mad. And apparently the tradition was that when an RAF guy is killed flying, the Ministry of Defence pick up his last mescal. So as a way of a wake and saying goodbye, they all go to the bar and drink. And I have to say, I when they said come in, the two of us sort of looked at each other and said, this can't be real, this can't be legal. I mean, to hell with it being legal. What a brilliant idea. What an absolutely inspired idea. So, of course, we went in and had a few beers, but we had to catch the plane, so we disappeared. But that apparently is still the case, having been back to RAF messes since then, and have done 4-day controllers courses and stuff. I now know that is a recognised and acceptable practice within the RAF. And I have to say, it's quite a fitting way to say goodbye to somebody who they've known throughout their service.
Okay, and so when it came to, once you'd been there for the 4 months, was this, like I heard you say, that it's a 6-month tour of duty, was it?
6 months tour of duty, mm-hmm. Yep. So no, I just did 4 months, yeah.
So you were expecting to come back in?
Oh, yep. We were all, we handed over to the Paras, I remember. Paras came in, we did a handover in situ, so they were taking around all the Sanger positions. All the key people were taken around, flown around, shown them all. But then what would happen was you'd get a platoon or half platoon of Paras, and they would go into the Sanger. They would have a chance to be debriefed by a couple of the jocks over a period of about an hour. So you get all the bits and pieces, all the what's happening outside, where the geography is of the building, what goes on where, what the daily routine is, etc. And then those jocks would get on the helicopter, which would disappear somewhere else, doing something else, come back and get them in a period of time. So that this handover, the advance party arrived a week before the main body arrived. And so we were showing them all this stuff, and likewise we were thinning out boys as they brought their people in. We were the last to to sort of go out. The rest all flew. I went back to APC camp, and the rest all flew back by jet, and I was coming back on a Hercules. So it was going to be a long, long flight back from Belize, but that's what we did. We got on the Hercules, bought the kit, laid out in the loading bay, and we basically set up a camp on top of the kit, amongst all these loading straps and tie-down nets, and went to sleep in a sleeping bag, because it was freezing, absolutely freezing, when you're flying at 26, 27,000 feet in the back of Hercules, absolutely freezing. So you're in a sleeping bag, and you just go to sleep for about, we had to stop once, so we got some food, but otherwise you just slept there.
Indeed,
I never heard it stopped. We came back to
Edinburgh. But the
Hercules... It wasn't Washington, it was one of the military airstrips on the eastern board coast. We then flew straight across, straight to Scotland. We didn't have to go out by Greenland and Iceland and that way. We could just go straight across.
And it was still on the Hercules?
Oh, yeah. I think it took 17 hours, I think it was.
Okay, and did you come back to Edinburgh?
Yeah, we flew to Edinburgh, okay. Which was great.
And was the whole battalion in Edinburgh?
We were all at Curtin Union, yes.
Okay, so you're back
there. We all came back to Curtin Union, yeah.
Okay, and did you stay there for long?
I went away. What happened then?
Did you get some leave or anything?
Oh, yeah, we had a couple of weeks leave, yeah, definitely. I came back to post my missus. She said to me, which is very important, and the file was just a bit to get rid of it.
Don't believe that.
What happened then? Oh, yes. I went to London on a course, forward air controllers course. That was done down at RAF Broadie and Haddonfield West in West Wales. So I learned all about how to control fast jets in an operational environment, which is great. Very interesting. Thoroughly enjoyed it. It was taken up in a fast jet. It was, pilot gave me a chance to fly a jet Provis. I made a complete horlicks of that. But I did enjoy it. And he said, yeah, you'd be very brave because you just pulled 6G without a G suit on. Yeah. It's something. And then he got me to go up in a Hawk trainer. And we did some, well, he didn't fly me, but I was in the Hawk trainer with one of their pilots. And we went into the Brecon Beacons and we were following tornadoes around. Which was just the most amazing experience. That was that. And I got a very good grade on my forward air controllers course. I got married when I came back from that. And I was called back to my honeymoon because the Falklands War started. So we were called back. I got married on the 26th of March 82, and we've been on holiday for a week, so it's probably about the 2nd or 3rd of April. I was told to come back because my company, or not my company, Finlay McLean's company, D Company, which I was 2IC on, lastly, they were the captain, I forget the exact terminology, we were the on-call company for the battalion, and the battalion was the on-call battalion for the army. Now, we had, obviously, this is 4 months after Belize, but we were still operationally one of the most up-to-speed battalions in the army. And so we all got back and we were briefed that we were going to be sent to the Falklands, which all sounded very good. I was just a bit because I'd done my forward air controllers course and I was going to be usefully employed, you know, bringing in jets, etc. And I think it was probably part of it was, I say bravado, but they made the point that to the Argentinians that they're sending a party down, and of course our battle group was ready, but we were going to go, D Company was going to go ahead of them. So we were doing that, and we were being sent, and then suddenly we were told, oh, you've got to go to Gibraltar. So we went to Gibraltar, stopped there, basically because they had a change of heart. They were going to send the parachute brigade and the commander brigade. The parachute brigade would be made up of paratroopers from 2 and 3 para, Scots Guards and some Gurkhas. Now, with all due respect to the Scots Guards, they haven't done any operational tours in about 7 years because they had been at the the Public Duties Battalion in London. So they had to do some very, very quick training, and things were difficult for them. And we felt very hurt that having just come back from an operational tour where we were absolutely up to speed and everybody's drills and understanding was of the highest order, that we were sidelined. So we were in Gibraltar for moments, and then we were told, go to Cyprus. So we went back to Cyprus again. And we spent 6 weeks in Cyprus. They basically said, well, we'll just send you there. The rest of the battalion didn't go anywhere. They stayed in Kernu. But we got to Cyprus, and we were basically being held there in reserve at this point, because they thought, you know, that having got the task force together, and they were going to sail a lot of these soldiers down on the Canberra and other ships, and they would fly some special air service, etc., special boat service down, and they would do some sea insertions and all this sort of stuff. So that plan kicked off, but we then spent the rest of the time swanning it in Cyprus, because we were never going to get called forward. The war went well from the British point of view, so there was no need to send us. I know we lost 69 people out there, some of which could have been avoided, of course, but we weren't required.
And how did you get down to Gibraltar? Were you flown down there, or was it by ship? You know,
like we were flown there. It was a very, I don't know what we were going to do. I don't know where they were going to fly us to. You know, we'd have got to Ascension Island, effectively. That's as far as we'd have got, because the next stop is the Falklands. And they weren't going to land in the Falklands. So, yeah, exactly that. We were flown to Gibraltar, and then flown to Cyprus.
And you know when you said as well that you were recalled from your honeymoon? Mm-hmm. Were you in honeymoon within Britain, or was you outside Britain?
Well, I take it Colonsay and the West Coast is probably in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
But I was on Ireland.
Okay.
And it was very funny because the folk of Colonsay likened the situation in the Falklands to them taking on the Isle of Jura, which is 14, 15 miles away, which they can see. And it was like here the Falkland Islanders on the Colonsay being invaded by the Juran people who are Argentinian. And it was hugely funny in the pub, that this was going on, albeit it was serious. But I was called back.
And how did you feel, not about so much, obviously I think when I got upset, but about being called back into this situation, being in the military, had you had any warning that the Falklands would be invaded? Had you heard of the Falklands?
Oh yeah, I'd heard of them, definitely heard of it. Knew quite a bit about it, but absolutely no inkling at all that it was going to be invaded. That said, in hindsight, I think the British Army had to ask, or the military defence had to ask the question, why all of a sudden did the Argentinians ask for all the map coverage of the Falklands, the Malvinas as they called it, and most of our Royal Engineer map supplies were sent to Argentina. So when we got there, of course, hang on guys, where are all the maps? Oh, I gave them to, what do you call it, in Buenos Aires. Why? Because there was an order placed through and I was told that we'd go ahead. This was done, maybe years, months certainly, in advance of the invasion. But they've been planning this for a while. But there was no other inkling, and nobody thought in the map depth to say, it's strange, asking all these maps and problems. Ah, probably because the guy never heard of it. Didn't know any more about it, just thought that was just an island.
And when you were being sent away as well, how well equipped were you? You know, did you have a lot of kit or anything with you?
Yeah, we had all our frontline kit. So we were, as well prepared as one can be.
And what was frontline kit at that time?
Well, we had, obviously the clothes you stand up in, but you had three sets of combats, two pairs of boots, all your underwear, helmets, webbing, rucksack, stuff sack, waterproofs, gloves, ponchos, personal weapons, radios, ammunition, food, water, all the things that we were totally familiar with and knew, some of the stuff, you know, our stuff stack was really just the luxury stuff. That's where you get this spare stuff. And 9 times out of 10, you never ever own that stuff stack. But everything had to go. Dog tags, respirators. I mean, you took everything that you're supposed to have, which is a lot of stuff. I mean, it's easily over 120 pounds worth of weight, easily.
Okay, and so you went to Gibraltar. You just stayed there a short time.
Oh, very short time. We hardly even got off the plane.
And then you got to Cyprus.
Yeah.
And was that to the same place as where?
Exactly the same. We went through the same exercise that we'd done when I was there in the demonstration time. We did some adventure training. We did some beach landings. Because they realised they weren't going to send us, but because that's why they did it, because the parachute regiment was supposed to be doing that exercise, they were retasked, so we basically were told, well, you can go and do the exercise. I mean, it was great, but because I'd done it before, I was actually in a very prominent role to be able to advise Finn McLean, the company commander, how we could make it better, and how we could do it. It was only, you know, sort of 2 or 3 years ago I'd done it. And we had a great time. Pissed off at missing the football sport, but kind of always.
But were you still on call at that time?
Yeah. That's why we were doing the training. We were a fit bunch of guys, with a lot of running, exercise, sport, adventure training. Because you've got to keep the boys interested, because they were annoyed at not being sent. So you've got to get their minds off it. You can't let them get melancholy. You've got to keep them working. And we did some good exercises, some great skating innovations, really good skating innovation exercise, which lasted a week. And that really got there. Yeah, they really enjoyed that, because that was the nearest thing to real soldiering. We did some live firing, which was good. It was a thoroughly good 6 weeks. And by the time, of course, we came back, the performance was finished.
And where did you come back to?
We were flown back to Edinburgh.
So was it back to rejoin the rest of
the Yeah. Because the rest had been back there, they hadn't been anywhere.
And so where did you go after that? Did you stay in Edinburgh for a while? Or?
After that, I was posted to Warminster. I think I went back to Warminster to be... No, I'm telling a lie, sorry, no. After Edinburgh, we were going to go to Hamer in Germany. 1983, we were going to Hamer. We were going there as a mechanised battalion, and I was quite au fait with mechanised work, because I'd been when I was at the demonstration battalion, a lot of my work was done with the armoured personnel carrier, the 432. So I was used to operating in a mechanised warfare environment. I was used to working with all the radio setups that they had there. So that, from my point of view, was great, because I was one of the only guys in town that actually remembered it and was current, because the Gordons hadn't been in Germany since 1968. So, you know, they a lot of them had left and didn't have the track-bashing mentality. So that was good. So we went to Hamer, which is not far from Dortmund, in the western side of what was then West Germany. And we went to a barracks called, we went to Dielinghofen, which is at the top of the hill above Hamer. It's funny how all our barracks are at the top of hills, surrounded by an enormous forest. Barossa barracks, Dielinghofen in Hamer. And Jane and I had a lovely quarter down in Hamer itself. The system there is not quite the same as elsewhere. The officers lived in houses or flats, but they were mixed in with the German population. So you might have a flat of four people. You might have myself or Gordon. We had a woofer, Worcestershire Forester, above us, and there was a German lady opposite, and then there was an engineer, and then the houses inside of us are both German. And then you had another military flat system with four officers, so it might have been two Gordons or whatever. But it was a great mixture, and it was really very pleasant. And for a first married quarter, as such, it wasn't the first we had in Edinburgh, but as a first flat, it was great. Really, very good. The job in in Hamer, within about 4 weeks of being there, we were told we were no longer going to be mechanized.